produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Daily Audio Stash is where responsible marijuana smokers listen in on the latest news about cannabis, hear the voices of the marijuana law reform movement in special segments and interviews, and kick back with comedy and music no other podcast can offer. It's Normal's Daily Audio Stash. More information at normalaudiostash.com. First up today, it's news from Normal. Our news today. San Francisco's supervisors approve deprioritization ordinance. San Francisco County supervisors have approved an ordinance to make marijuana enforcement the city's lowest law enforcement priority. The ordinance was approved 2-1 by the Board of Supervisors City Operations and Neighborhood Services Committee last week, and approved 8-3 by the full board yesterday. The Board of Supervisors are expected to confirm the vote next week, making San Francisco the sixth California municipality to approve such a measure. Under the new ordinance, police are directed to essentially ignore most marijuana crimes, unless they involve minors or acts of violence, driving under the influence or the sale or distribution of marijuana on public property or within view from public property. The measure also establishes a citizens' advisory board to monitor whether police are complying with the law. The ordinance's sponsor, Supervisor Tom Amiano, called the measure a, quote, question of priorities, plain and simple, close quote, noting that the Bush administration has made marijuana top priority, and San Francisco should set its own policy. The ordinance was supported by a coalition of drug reform and marijuana groups, as well as the San Francisco public defender Jeff Adachi. The district attorney and San Francisco Police Department were officially neutral. San Francisco Police Department Narcotics Chief Captain Tim Hetrick surprised the committee last week by stating that the proposed ordinance was in line with SFPD's existing policy. Amiano had incorporated some amendments proposed by the SFPD, such as a clause exempting sales, quote, within view, close quote, of public property from the lowest priority provision. Although the city doesn't track marijuana arrests and prosecutions, the Normal Foundation has stated that more than 1,000 people were arrested in cases involving marijuana in San Francisco in 2004. Voters in three California cities, Santa Barbara, Santa Cruz, and Santa Monica, also approved pot deprioritization initiatives in last week's midterm elections. Oakland voters endorsed a similar ordinance in 2004, as did the West Hollywood City Council this past summer. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit NORML.org. Today on the program, we'll have our regular weekly conversation with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. We'll also check in with Colorado's Safer Campaign and the director there, Mason Tavert. We also have some great music today from podshow.com. But first, our weekly conversation about the science of marijuana. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at State University of New York and author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book Pot Politics. We have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com. And Dr. Earlywine joins us each Wednesday here on the Audio Stash to discuss the science of marijuana. Mitch, welcome back to the show today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Mitch, there's a new research article out this week that's right up your alley. It's entitled, Does Occasional Cannabis Use Impact Anxiety and Depression Treatment Outcomes? Something that struck me in the first read of this article is that the authors mention that the cannabis users in this study had lower income. How does that factor come into play medically?
It's curious. I don't know if we should make a big deal out of that with this sample, but essentially the folks who reported they used once a month or more did have a lower income than the folks who reported not using at least once a month. And I'm wondering if, in fact, it's just a product of who's willing to fess up to using that often and who necessarily has the kinds of priorities where, oh, I'm willing to go out and just work and make all the money I can, might not be the kind of person who also happens to enjoy cannabis recreationally.
And does income become a factor in any individual being able to treat psychological conditions?
As it turns out, some of the private, you know, sources for psychological support are really expensive. What I like about this study is that the treatments for anxiety and depression were provided for folks in a really inexpensive format, and most any listener should be able to find a local mental health center near wherever he or she lives and get some treatment for a reasonable price.
Mitch, let's talk about the conditions in the study here, anxiety and panic. What are some of the symptoms people experience from these?
So anxiety itself, the generalized anxiety disorder, is just a sort of free-floating angst, this constant worry, the notion that something bad is going to happen at any time, and then a lot of physical arousal that goes with that. So they report sweaty palms and rapid heart and just a lot of sort of teeth-grinding, wound-up phenomena, whereas panic is a distinct incident where suddenly they feel like they're going crazy, they're spinning around, their hearts are beating really quickly, and there's a lump in their throat and they can hardly function, and that panic disorder is a separate disorder and has those distinct qualities.
In the treatments mentioned here, one is collaborative care therapy. What does that mean?
There's a wonderful program that's been developed over the years by Michelle Krask and Bricker and some of the other authors on this paper, where they essentially get these people to come in and expose themselves to some of these anxiety symptoms. Go ahead and do things that will make you feel like you're going to panic in order to get used to that and to sort of take the power away from that, if you will, so that they're less anxious in their daily lives and they're less likely to have a panic attack.
There are also some drugs that are prescribed to treat these conditions.
That's correct, and some of the drugs have some pretty good luck with generalized anxiety, not quite as much support for the panic disorder, but my disappointment with that approach has always been that once you go off the drug, of course, the symptoms return. Anxiety and panic in particular really lend themselves to good behavioral treatments and you know, 3 months of good hard work and you can really have it kicked for life. So I think that that's better than paying for some kind of prescription for years and years.
It's pointed out in the study that people with anxiety or panic also show depressive symptoms. Is that part and parcel with those conditions or a cause and effect factor going on here?
In fact, the distinction between depression and anxiety is not perfect. As you can imagine, if you're really anxious all the time, you might get depressed, or if you're really depressed, you might get anxious. So they're not perfectly separated. And that, I think, accounts for a lot of that overlap. Now, the notion that monthly users are more depressed in this sample says something about who shows up for treatment, because as we've discussed in two big samples, one of mine from the Internet and another one, a longitudinal data set, suggests that regular users aren't more depressed. One caveat about this new study, though, is they didn't let folks who smoked once a week or more be part of these analyses. And so I think that that's curious that we've got this kind of interesting subset of folks who smoke once a month but not as much as once a week, and then what a surprise, we do get these quirky findings with their depressive symptoms.
Mitch, can smoking cannabis once a month or less have any impact on these conditions?
It seems unlikely for depressive symptoms. I mean, my friends who have migraine or, you know, intermittent kinds of disorders where cannabis can be helpful do often use once a month or less. There's some insights, if you're willing to, you know, go with me with this, that often come with the intoxication experience about, gee, how do my thoughts relate to my mood? And a lot of times folks report they have an insight on a, you know, even a single incident with cannabis, and that actually helps some of their depressive symptoms and the way they look at the world, but we don't have a ton of data to support that yet.
So this is more about a state of mind an individual can get into when they experience marijuana intoxication. And this can be a form, it sounds like it can be a form of behavioral self-training in itself.
My mood is dependent upon my thoughts. Well, one of the lessons, if you will, of cannabis intoxication is, holy cow, I can really pay attention to my thoughts and kind of separate myself from them and realize I am not my thoughts. And with that in mind, either accept them for what they are as just thoughts and not be particularly depressed about them, or even change them. Say, hey, wow, the way I'm looking at this is not, you know, taking into account my full life and the way I really see the world, and then having that thought have less impact or change to a more adaptive thought.
Mitch, that's a fascinating concept. What's at work here? Do we just worry less when we're experiencing the intoxication of pot?
I'm really in the realm of conjecture here, but what I think is going on is that cannabis decreases attentional capacity. And when you look at like the impact on attentional problems that cannabis has, it's that you sort of focus in on whatever is right there in front of you. If it's a depressing thing, you can imagine how cannabis could actually make depressive symptoms worse, or at least your mood worse, and you could have kind of a bum-out experience. If it's a pleasant thing, you would obviously have that pleasant experience enhanced. I'm eager to see if, for example, attentional tasks that are related to cannabis would bear this out, and that's the direction I think that's going.
This study was of 232 individuals. Do we get good data from this size of a group?
Actually, as depression and anxiety treatments go, this is a large sample, because you can imagine how hard it is to find these folks and to get them to, you know, do these 12-month follow-ups. Nevertheless, I'm eager to see a study like this get replicated, and it takes multiple sites and a lot of funding, but I'm optimistic that with data like this, the federal funding agencies can get behind this idea.
And for those who may have anxiety or panic conditions, what would be a good guideline for their use of marijuana?
Well, there's a subset of folks who have a pretty rapid and frequent anxious reaction to cannabis, and of course they should stay away. A lot of that can be strain-specific, and unfortunately we just don't have the legal market to investigate the different strains in order to see which ones might create that experience and which ones would not. But the biggest recommendation I can make is go hook up with a mental health provider who provides cognitive behavioral therapy, and often at the local mental health center you can do this with relatively little expense, and you know, really work hard for a good 3 months, and you'll be stunned at the progress you can make with just you know, an hour a week and doing your homework, and suddenly you're a whole new person. And then if you want to include cannabis in your life down the line, it looks like at least at rates of between once a month and once a week, there's really no negative impact. So that would be something to keep in mind as well.
So it sounds like experiencing marijuana intoxication really helps with that broader self-realization to help deal with the physical or psychological condition. Not to get too new agey here, but that's what helps with our biofeedback, I guess.
Well, and I think what happens really is you start to pay attention to your own thoughts and your own mood. If anybody deserves to know what you think and how you feel, it's you. And if cannabis provides that lesson, that's great. But I'd love to see folks generalize to their unintoxicated experience as well to say, I'm going to pay attention to what I think and how I feel and make my decisions accordingly.
Mitch, this has been another wonderful discussion. I really appreciate your joining us each week here on the Audio Stash.
It was wonderful, and looking forward to doing it again.
Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at State University of New York and author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book Pot Politics. We have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com, and Dr. Earlywine joins us each Wednesday here on the program to discuss the science of marijuana. And in our continued coverage of the different midterm election ballot initiatives regarding marijuana, today we'll speak with Mason Tevert from Safer in Colorado. Mason Tevert is the campaign coordinator for Safer Alternative for Enjoyable Recreation in Colorado. Mason helped bring in over 500,000 votes in favor of Amendment 44 last week and joins us today for a roundup of that campaign. Mason, welcome back to the Audio Stash today.
Thanks for having me.
Mason, while Amendment 44 did not pass, the actual votes did much better than the pre-election polling supposed.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it just once again showed that this is going to be underreported in the polls every time. This is what happened last year. It happened again this year. They said that it was going to be in the 30s, and it turned out to be a lot higher. We really ended up with it's going to be at, when all things are said and done, about 41 to 59. And what that shows is that 2 in 5 people, voters in Colorado, do not think we should be punishing adults who use marijuana. It's a pretty solid message. And we are hoping that the state will take notice of that.
There was a very strong turnout overall there in Colorado last week for the election. Did the SAFER initiative play a part in getting that turnout?
I mean, we really did everything possible to make sure everyone was aware of this. We were more or less, while we did do a lot of GOTV efforts and register a lot of voters around college campuses and so on, we really did whatever we could to inject ourselves into the news and make sure this was something that was on everyone's mind, being talked about in everyone's office, everyone's dorm room and so on, and we think that we really did have a pretty good effect on the turnout. There were some voting irregularities and problems in Denver that occurred, which made some national headlines, and that undoubtedly took away some of the vote for us, but not nearly, you know, we're hardly laying blame on that. I don't think it would have made a huge difference, less than a point, but there's no doubt that a number of people in Denver, possibly many who came out just to vote on this initiative, didn't get the chance to.
Mason, you live in Denver. Did you see those voting problems in person?
Absolutely. I mean, I voted early, and it took me an hour and a half just to do that, and that was on my second try. The first time it was too long of a line. I couldn't do it. But on Election Day, I mean, we had people, I mean, our own volunteers were waiting in 2-hour, 3-hour lines, and these are people who had dedicated their time and their efforts to helping this out, and they were dedicated enough to stay in those lines and until they got the chance to vote. But a lot of people probably just gave up, said, you know, well, everyone else is voting, so I'll just take off.
And what did you see as the main factor in those long lines?
It was like, the big problem in Denver was that they had computer problems. They really had big problems with monitoring registration, having people come in and verifying that they were registered and so on. I think at some points it was taking 10 minutes per voter just to verify that they were registered. Lines were moving very slow, then that computer system went down. It was just very poorly organized, and what was even more frustrating is that the people knew that there were going to be serious voting problems from months back, and really didn't do a whole lot. I mean, in my personal opinion, the Democrats knew this was coming, and they really spent a lot of time encouraging people to vote early and voting absentee rather than raising a stink about why we should have a valid election day.
Once you got up to the voting machine, what was that experience like?
It wasn't bad. You know, it was interesting. I mean, it was very similar to, you know, just going to an ATM. You know, you walk up there, you just push the screen, and it was very simple. And then what was interesting is they print out a paper trail, which kind of like rolls past the screen to your left, but it's like behind glass. So it's not like a piece of paper you can keep, but they just kind of show you a receipt of all of your votes, and you get to look at it and then, you know, make sure it says what you said and so on. I mean, I'm still a little skeptical, but, you know, it wasn't a voting itself, like once I got up to the computer screen, wasn't a huge problem. Now, whether those things are, you know, being hacked into or whatever, I have no idea.
And how much of an impact did these voting problems in Denver have on the election overall there in Colorado, do you think?
I mean, there's a few races that very well were decided by, that will have been decided by that, some more important than others, but some of them are still hanging in the balance. I mean, the state region at large, it's the University of Colorado elects a Board of Regents. That's a statewide office, which is currently up in the air and could be decided by anywhere from 1 to 50 to 1,000 votes. And the fact that a lot of people, particularly Democrat-leaning people, did not end up voting because of these problems is probably going to have an effect on that. And I think it certainly had an effect on us. But, you know, like I said, I don't think it tipped our scales in any way.
Mason, the weekend before the election, SAFER ran some pretty amazing newspaper ads with photos of President Bush and Vice President Cheney in Colorado Springs and Greeley. How do you think those ads worked?
Well, they worked more or less perfectly because what they did is not only they got our message across, but they also appeared in newspapers and on TV shows from not only in Colorado and around the country, but even internationally. I mean, these things were popping up on Australian news sites and in the Australian newspapers. And, you know, we were fortunate enough to just you know, have these concepts, and I guess people in other countries like poking fun at American leadership. So when they got out there, you know, they were spread around pretty quick. And, you know, it's just not something you see every day, a group of marijuana activists poking fun at the substance abuse habits of our president and vice president. So, you know, they really got our point across in saying that, you know, these are two responsible leaders of our country, but even though they're responsible leaders, or well, some might have questions about that, but even though they are, you know, in such a high leadership role, they have had problems as a solely as a result of drinking. And we simply wanted to bring that to people's attention and get them thinking. And this was a way to really captivate the media into getting our message across.
Mason, national media had sort of tunnel vision on another set of ballot initiatives in Colorado regarding civil unions and gay marriage. Do you think having a marijuana initiative on the ballot with other contentious issues had any impact?
You know, I think it could go either way, more or less. I mean, what's one thing that a lot of people, you know, Democrats would try to say, oh, well, having a marijuana initiative is bad for Democrats because it's going to bring out, you know, conservative people who want to vote against marijuana. I think that's insane. It's definitely not the case. If anything, having a marijuana initiative on the ballot is going to lend to Democratic efforts and probably lend to more progressive types of initiatives. I think what's very interesting is that this state voted to ban gay marriage. It voted to reject domestic partnerships. And yet it still voted 40% in favor of making marijuana legal, which, you know, obviously I'm personally not really thrilled with the voters' decisions on those first two things I mentioned. But the fact is that even though this people here are still traditional and relatively conservative when it comes to the issues of gay rights, they are, you know, really starting to open up on the issues regarding marijuana. And I think that, you know, I think the gay rights measures certainly brought out a number of voters who cared about that. And I'm sure that those people are likely very sympathetic to the marijuana issue.
It seems that this could be an indicator that voters are motivated to turn out as much by marijuana as they are by gay marriage, something the media has played as very contentious and a hotly debated topic.
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, I don't want to jump to conclusions and saying that any, you know, that we're more important than the issue of gay rights. I mean, I think it's a very important issue as well. But I think there's, you know, certainly there's valid points to be made about, you know, motivating voters and whether they're turning out solely for one issue or not. I personally believe that a lot of folks who are motivated by the gay rights issues are people who are generally active anyway. I don't think that's the case with marijuana. So I think there's more going on with the gay rights movement. I think that it does have more support. I mean, obviously the domestic partnership issue at least got more votes than we did, but what's interesting is that our issue is starting to get new people and younger people active in a way that I don't think the others are. I think it's a very unique issue, and I think that it's got great potential to get young people interested in having the chance to vote, because, I mean, for many of these young people and old people alike who might use marijuana or know people who use marijuana, this is literally a chance to vote to keep yourself from being a criminal. And that's not something that people vote on often. So I think that it's a kind of a subconscious thing that people, you know, are really pushed to be like, oh, well, I've got the chance to make marijuana legal, I'm going to go vote. And we'll see with when we start to see polling data and whatever. Hopefully we'll some people will do that work for us, and we'll be able to look and see if we had any effect on this.
And Mason, what's the next step for the Safer Alternative there in Colorado?
We are going to maintain everything that's going on here in Colorado. We have a really big and powerful infrastructure of volunteers that has kind of popped up as a result of our efforts over the last couple of years. So we will continue to be here and working on issues around here. We're starting to discuss, you know, future initiatives, the possibility of doing something with regard to tax and regulation, the possibility of starting to approach some of the legislators, seeing if we can get something referred to the ballot rather than simply petitioning. It's obviously an expensive and timely process. But more importantly, we are moving on to start on revisit our roots with the college campuses. We got our start at the University of Colorado and Colorado State, passing student initiatives saying that the penalties for marijuana should not be greater than for alcohol violations. And we've been successful at CU, CSU, and then just this past year with the help of some student normal chapters as well as Sensible Students for Sensible Drug Policy chapters. We passed those initiatives at Florida State, the University of Texas Austin, and University of Maryland. And this coming spring semester, we want to have at least like 20, if not more, 30 of these things going on around the country to really just show that this is a big national movement. Students are starting to get active on this, and we're going to see some changes soon.
Mason, how about you personally? Are you going to stay there in Colorado?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, I really enjoy living here. I've been here for the last couple of years, and I think this is where SAFER is going to be based for some time. I would personally like to see this thing in Colorado through until it happens. I mean, my personal goal would be to have it done by the time I'm 30, would be nice. Then I can get a job that actually pays decently, but I plan on sticking around. I think that SAFER can adequately run from Colorado. I don't think we need to be in D.C. or anything like that. We're not doing any lobbying, and so I plan on sticking around here and seeing this thing through.
Mason, it really has been great speaking with you throughout this election season, and a big congratulations again for the over 500,000 votes for Amendment 44.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Mason DeVert is the campaign coordinator for Safer Alternative for Enjoyable Recreation in Colorado, where, as you heard, he will continue the fight for Americans' right to choose. You can find out more online at saferchoice.org. And now it's time for some podshow.com music. Here's a group we found up there called the Chronic Clan. Here's Gimme the Weed.
Ayo, I am blazing the Rasta. A high grade. On a pass me some.
I'm going to call it that.
And it's a dope thing, man. A wicked ganja. Lord God, tell the policeman for free with. Ayo!
Ganja fi blaze, ganja fi blaze. Ganja fi blaze, ganja fi blaze. Well, give me the ganja, get a
even in a daytime. We build it downtown, we are to build it uptown. Oi, Babylon, and them can't stop this one. For in Africa, we used to smoke with ganja, and we never experience about no cancer. Till the Babylon, and them are broke at them Gaza. Well, them are put here with life in danger.
Give me the weed, that's what I need. When I smoke it, satisfaction.
This has been Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Thanks to Podshow.com for all the great pod-safe music. We feature the band Carne Cruda as our theme. Make sure you visit our website at NormalAudioStash.com. That's NormalAudioStash.com for more information about every day's show. Thanks to Red Aphid Interactive Media for the podcasting technology. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow. If you listen to the Audio Stash, cast your vote at Podcast Alley or other podcast directory services. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.